Welcome back to Radio Entrepreneurs. I'm Jonathan Friedman, and today we're at the law firm of Murphy & King, learning from their attorneys how they solve their clients' problems through unraveling complexity. And my next guest today is Kate Cruikshank. Hi, Kate. How are you?
Good. How are you, Jonathan?
Great. Kate practices in the Bankruptcy and Financial Restructuring Group and helps with clients that are insolvent in some capacity and help them to protect their assets. Wherever possible. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I know it's an important topic for people. How do you protect your assets when things aren't going so well? So, Kate, if you don't mind me asking, what can individuals and couples do in order to protect their assets when they're facing financial hardship?
Well, let me take you a step backwards and tell you sort of as a preface that ideally, protecting assets is a long-term strategy for an individual or a couple. The best thing you can do is to try to make some plans before you get into financial trouble. Because in some instances, things that you might try to do to protect yourself once you are in financial trouble will just cause greater cause you a greater problem. So,
and that has to do with the look-back period? And
yes.
Okay,
so
not to get too technical, yes. But I'm somewhat aware of that. But so what people do preventatively, if you will, is a good step to take.
Yes. So the things that you can do if you have the time, first of all, I would always recommend that you update your insurance, sit down with a professional, and make sure that there's no gaps in your coverage, so you can have peace of mind in that regard. Another thing you might want to do is consider starting a trust to put your assets in. And not all trusts are created equal. I'd tell a client you would want to have the trust be an irrevocable trust, meaning that you can't change your mind once you set up the trust. In addition, you as the grantor of the trust can't be the beneficiary of the trust. So you'd probably want to make the beneficiaries of the trust your family members, your spouse, and your children. If you remain a beneficiary of the trust under Massachusetts law, that's considered a self-settled trust, even if you're one of several of the beneficiaries. And under long-settled Massachusetts law, if you are able to get at income or the assets of a trust, your creditors can likewise reach the trust. So the idea is to have it be irrevocable and for you not to remain a beneficiary. Of course, a downside of that is you don't necessarily have the control anymore. So that's something that people have to weigh in deciding about whether or not they want to protect their assets in that way. Another option is in some states, you can set up a domestic asset protection trust. In New Hampshire, that's a possibility. There's a statute that's been in place since about 2009. But it's not clear that Massachusetts law would really honor that. That kind of a trust allows the grantor of the trust to remain as a beneficiary in certain instances. But as I said, not clear at all that that would be something that would be honored in Mass law. So I would talk to people about the trusts. I would talk to them about life insurance with cash value that they can, if set up the right way, they can maintain that and protect that from creditors. I would also suggest that somebody contribute regularly to their retirement plan, because generally ERISA qualified retirement plans are exempt from creditors' reach.
Now, you know, the first thing that you talk about, an irrevocable trust and setting it up where you're no longer a beneficiary, I would imagine that you have to have pretty good faith that your relationships within your family are good and stable in order to make that work.
Sure.
Or is it defined within the trust, your income and what you may get?
Well, the trusts will, the trusts, you would set up the trust with terms, but if you as grantor had any ability to get any funds under the terms of the trust, your creditors could reach that.
Okay.
So
it's not foolproof from, but at least can protect the you know, if you had a cash flow that came out of the trust, it might not protect that, but it could protect the underlying assets. Is that?
Yeah, and it's the theory, and it really depends on how the trust is set up.
Okay.
So, you know, when we have people come to see us, usually that's sort of not in the picture. You know, we're dealing with, if there's a financial stress, then we're dealing with a different set of options. And so these are just ideas of things that you can do before there's a creditor suing you in the picture or there's financial distress in the picture.
And it sounds like those suggestions are just good practice if you've accumulated assets anyways, irrespective of what the situation might be. And I think that's sort of a proactive planning approach is what you're suggesting.
That's right. And, you know, if you want your assets to go to your children, you can set up a domestic asset trust that would help with the tax ramifications and maybe avoid probate, but you know, which are separate reasons mm-hmm. that people do those things.
So talk to us a little bit about protection of primary residence and you know, homes, things of that nature, because I know that's probably for most people outside of their business, if they have one, their single largest asset.
That's right. So when typically if somebody approaches us and they're in financial distress, we would normally look at the house because, as you said, that's probably most people's most valuable asset.
Especially if you bought a long time ago in this area.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so there's a couple things to look at. Under, if you're facing a bankruptcy, you would have a choice between federal law and state law as to how you could exempt some of the equity in your home. So typically, because it's the most important and most valuable asset people have, if we're looking at a bankruptcy, we would choose the Massachusetts exemptions because they're generous. The federal exemptions that you could choose in a bankruptcy are much less generous. In Massachusetts, if you own a home either solely or in a tenancy by the entirety, or if you own it jointly with a joint tenancy with right of survivorship, you have the ability to exempt up to $500,000 in equity in your home. And that is whole and unallocated. So even if the wife were to file bankruptcy without her husband, she could exempt the entire, she could use the whole $500,000 in equity to protect that.
Okay, so it doesn't get split and saying...
In some instances, okay. It would get split. If you owned a property as tenants in common, or if you owned a property as one of several beneficiaries of a trust, and that's, I should take a step back and say, in 2011, Massachusetts changed the law. In 2011, Massachusetts changed the law so that beneficiaries of trusts could exempt their interest in a home. But if you're one of, say, five beneficiaries, you can only exempt one-fifth of the 500, so it's allocated in that case. So tenants in common and beneficiaries of a trust can only exempt a percentage
of the proportional share of the,
exactly.
of the beneficiary
exactly.
Of the asset.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about spendthrift trusts and how those work to protect assets from creditors.
Well, normally a spendthrift trust is to protect the beneficiary from themselves. So it's usually to, if you're a beneficiary of the trust, it's designed so that your creditors cannot reach the assets of the trust. And they've been uniformly upheld in Massachusetts, except that if you are the creator of the or the grantor of the trust, that's considered a self. If you're the grantor and the beneficiary of the trust, that's considered a self-settled trust, and in that case, the spendthrift provision would not protect you regardless.
So help me with and our listeners understand. I guess a scenario would be. A beneficiary, offspring, if you will, somebody who has, you know, a lifestyle that gets them into trouble either financially or what have you, and they have a spendthrift trust set up. Those creditors that were after that individual can't go after the other trust that they're a beneficiary of. So they're limited to their liabilities, essentially, as opposed to anything that they may benefit from a trust that's set up elsewhere. Is that...
You know, you have to go trust by trust, if I understand your question. But usually, if you're setting up a spendthrift trust, you're doing it because you're concerned about maybe a child who's going to get a divorce, and you don't want the ex-spouse to be able to get at the assets, or that child is literally a spendthrift. You don't trust them to spend down all of that money. So it protects. There's usually controls on the amounts that the beneficiaries can receive, but if they're not the one that set up the trust, meaning the beneficiaries, in your example, the children, then the trust assets are protected.
Okay. So makes perfect sense. What about the protection of business assets?
Well, you know, sometimes a bankruptcy trustee in a Chapter 7 has the ability to attach your business assets if you don't have any corporate formality for your business. So if you are a sole proprietor and you own a number of vehicles as part of that business, say a snow plowing business or whatever, if you don't have those assets in a corporation, an LLC, you're not going to be able to protect them from creditors. So, because they're your assets and they okay. become part of the bankruptcy
so
estate.
So there's not that corporate shield in essence.
Right. So it's important if you have a business to set up an LLC or an LP in order to make that wall around the assets. Creditors can still attach your interest in the business, your membership interest or stock interest if it happens to be a corporation, but they can't necessarily force the distribution of the assets. It would depend on what the articles of organization say, but typically, and also typically the interest holders are last in line. If there's creditors of the corporation, they would come first. So it's much, much harder for a trustee or a creditor to get at assets that are in that business. But I would say that I would caution if you treat that business like it's your own without and don't respect the corporate formalities, then you're in danger of a creditor or a trustee, they call it piercing the corporate veil in bringing all those assets back into your personal domain so that they can be attached or liquidated in the case of a trustee. So
it's probably not all that uncommon an occurrence. I'm always flabbergasted when I hear people say, oh yeah, I have one checking account and I use it for personal, I use it for my business.
Yes.
And I always think to myself, that's a real red flag right there.
It's a complete red flag. And you know, in representing bankruptcy trustees, I see that all the time where even if it's a business checking account, the owner is using it to pay their mortgage, to pay their kids' right. tuition, to buy the groceries with an ATM card. Right. And that is all the ammunition. If I'm the trustee, that's what I'm looking for
right.
to get that veil pierced so I can get at the assets.
Right.
So
separate your universes, keep them separate by
absolutely.
Corporate documents, et cetera, and you know, pay yourself a salary and then pay those bills.
Absolutely. You're making great points. That's really what it's all about. So, and that's things that people don't pay attention to when there's financial distress or if they've just always been the only one running the company. So there is a reason for all those formalities.
So it works the same in reverse, I would imagine. You can't take your business assets and put them into your personal name and vice versa. There are look-back periods associated with...
Well, yes, there are. So if in that situation, you'd be talking about a business that files bankruptcy, whether it be a Chapter 7 or an 11 reorganization. If you're taking, as a principal, if you're taking assets out of the corporation, that can be subject to what's called a clawback.
Right.
You know, the transfer can be avoided. So that there's a good reason for keeping those formalities. So
excellent. So what's available to individuals in the event, and it reminds me of a commercial I hear on the radio all the time about elder care. It's never too late to do something if you're already finding a loved one in a nursing home. So what is available to individuals in the event that, you know, the proverbial boom is coming down and they haven't done any pre-planning or they haven't figured out how to protect? Are there some things that are available to try and protect those assets?
Yes, and honestly, that's probably the most common situation that we have. Is people are coming to us really when it's already that we're already in that zone.
It's
where
evident they're going downhill.
Yes, unfortunately. And so, you know, we I would sit down with a client like that and really try to understand everything that's going on, you know, to pick it apart so that I can understand what their exposure is. Because you want, and in this case, if you're looking at filing a bankruptcy, you want somebody who's on your team and who can frankly tell you all the risks that you have, the exposures you have. So for an individual or a couple, even if there's no homestead on the house, you can file a homestead just before you file a bankruptcy, and it will protect that equity in your house.
So there is no clawback on a homestead?
No, that's okay. Right. There are sometimes limitations on the $500,000 homestead under the bankruptcy code. It imposes certain limitations. So if you've owned a house in Massachusetts for less than, the number is 1,215 days, which is about 3 1/3 years. It's a ridiculous
it's an interesting number.
I think it was the product of compromise in the Congress. But if you've owned a house, the number, say it's about 3 1/3 years. If you've owned a house less than that, then you're capped at about $155,000. And that's a number that changes every 3 years, just indexed based on inflation. But that's, you're looking at that limitation. But if you had another house in Massachusetts and you rolled the equity over to purchase a new house, you wouldn't be subject to that. But sometimes there's other times where that limitation can fall into place. If you've changed the nature of the ownership of the home, the court could look at it and say, well, your interest, you acquired a new interest and it's capped. If you've been convicted of a felony, and the court looks at it and says, well, it would be an abuse of what bankruptcy is really all about to let you have your whole $500,000 exemption. The court could also limit it to about $155,000. So that's really a kind of a case-by-case situation. And then there's also a section of the code that will limit you in the amount of equity you can exempt going back 10 years if you've paid down your equity in fraud of creditors. So say you own two houses, a house in Florida and a house in Massachusetts. You know you can't exempt them both. You sell the Florida house, take the money that you acquired, the equity, and paid down the mortgage. So you had, maybe you only had 100 and now you have 400,000 in equity. The court would look at that and say, well, if you paid this down in fraud of creditors, so we're not going to let you exempt that extra amount. So the law is really set up to try to prevent a ton of pre-petition planning. Mm-hmm. You know, typically a retirement account is fully exempt, but if you dump a lot of money into it just before you file, well, you're going to have a problem. So there's a limitation on how much you can put into it in the 5 years prior to the filing, and it's going to be 7% of your income. So there's different
thresholds, and different look
exactly.
back years.
And there's other exemptions that you can take.
What other types of exemptions are there?
So for your vehicle, and just let me say that the purpose of the exemption is to promote the idea of a fresh start in bankruptcy. So you're not walking away
stripped of everything.
Yeah, you're not stripped of everything. So if you have $7,500 in equity in a vehicle that you can exempt. If you're elderly or disabled, and the statute says you're 62, you're elderly, which I think needs to be rewritten. I think that's a little young, but then you get a $15,000 exemption. If a husband owns one vehicle and the wife owns another vehicle, then they can each exempt.
Now, are those cumulative exemptions when you say?
Well, in the case of spouses, and now it can be same-sex because of the change in the marriage laws, but in the case of two spouses, if they both file, they can stack their exemptions. So not the case with a home, but if the one spouse owns a car and another spouse owns a car, they're in each of their names, they can each exempt $7,500, or if they're older, it can be $15,000 apiece. The same thing with cash. There's exemptions for cash. They can, each spouse can exempt some. And that is a function of, each spouse has to own the asset that they are exempting. But you can stack exemptions. And in the case of, one kind of neat thing is if a spouse's own property, their home, in a tenancy by the entirety. There's another mass statute that will not allow a creditor to sell property if there are no joint debts. So if a spouse is owned property by tenancy by the entirety and there's no joint debts and one spouse files, the trustee can't sell. So
All fascinating and obviously a highly complex area.
Yeah.
Just a curious overarching question. When do people reach that point of knowing that it's time to file? I mean, is it self-evident or is it different for every person? It's not a quick mathematical equation.
No, it is different for every person. For a business, for example, a lot of times we see businesses when they are already in default with their lenders. Same thing with individuals. They might be in default with their mortgage company. There'll be creditors who are calling. They're ducking the calls. Usually, people come in response to external pressure. Might be a lawsuit, might be an attachment of wages. But, unfortunately, I think a lot of times, especially with companies, the management can be somewhat in denial or just, perpetually optimistic that
right.
they're going to get
We're
gonna through.
We're going to turn the corner, right.
Yeah, and so usually people are squeezed by the time they come see us. It's too bad because you have more options when you know it's coming a little further off into the future. For a business, we could do a forbearance with their lender, and help them create a plan short of a bankruptcy because, typically even lenders don't want
right.
a Chapter 11. They know it's expensive.
Right.
They would rather work it out with you.
Unless
there's some internal pressure going on at the lending institution that keeps them from doing it, or if there's been a long history, they might look disfavorably. But typically, it makes sense to come in a little bit before the stress is there. But, humans being who they are, people are people and they try to hang on as long as they can, I think. It might be pride. That might be pride.
So the guidance and advice you would provide to somebody is pre-plan. I don't want to take the words from you, but pre-plan if you can in advance and set up the structure in order to do so. And then if the writing is on the wall, be proactive.
Yes. The sooner that you consult with an attorney on this kind of thing, the better off you're going to be, the more options you're going to have. So the longer you wait, the less room you have to maneuver. You run out of, different options that we could work with. So
now I know that as you talk about it, so the bankruptcy provisions are set up to be able to provide people with a fresh start. Is a little bit counter to sort of the, and maybe it's a older misnomer of, the question on every credit application, have you ever declared bankruptcy, sort of the stigma associated with it. Is that an old way of thinking in terms of it, or they're very real and you just need to manage through it?
Yes, bankruptcy is still a stigma. I think it's a lot less so because so many people have filed bankruptcy. Older people, it's more of a stigma than younger people. And it does stay on your credit report, and it makes it more difficult to do things. But sometimes we find that clients who have received a discharge in bankruptcy will get credit cards offers right away because they know you can't discharge the debt for another 8 years. So, it really depends. If you've done an 11 or a 13, which is an individual plan of repayment, that's looked upon a little bit more favorably than just a straight 7. But there's definitely that stigma attached, but in the long run, I think the fresh start outweighs that because sometimes people don't realize how long that's going to remain as a drag on their life. So it's better to just put a stop to the bleeding and start
move
afresh.
Move forward.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Excellent. Well, Kate Cruickshank has been my guest on Radio Entrepreneurs, and you've taken obviously a very broad and very complex topic and tried to distill it down for our listeners. And if somebody wanted to get in touch with you and they were either at the front end and starting to plan alternatives or are starting to have inklings that they might want to head down this path, what's the best way for them to reach out to you?
I would say to just give me a call. And I'm on the website. My direct line is on there, or they can email me. So either way is fine. So I'm happy to talk to anybody that's got an urgent question and kind of talk you through it.
Excellent. Well, Kate, it was a pleasure having you on, and thank you so much for being on Radio Entrepreneurs.
You're welcome.
I'm sure you've got a lot of these issues to get back to with clients and help navigate through this these choppy waters, I guess, and helping to right the boat for them. Remind our listeners that we can be heard, this interview can be heard, as all our interviews can, across our social platforms as Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Google+. And the video portion of this interview available as well on our YouTube channel. And you can always visit us at radioentrepreneurs.com. Stay tuned after these messages. We'll be right back with another segment on Radio Entrepreneurs. A video highlighting segments of this podcast can be found on the Radio Entrepreneurs website, www.radioentrepreneurs.com, and the Murphy & King website, www.murphyking.com.